With a brief hearing on Senate Bill 324.
Oh.
Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 324 comes in from Senator Walker. Eliminates the ability of a court to make the terms of a settlement compromise of a lawsuit against government and the official of a place government confidential, entirely confidential. You have before you the dash one set of amendments, which are allow the settlement to be made confidential under certain limited circumstances if required by federal law or if one of the persons involved is under 18 and the judge finds, after weighing all the factors, that it could be better to have the settlement remain confidential.
Senator Walker, you look very ready to testify.
Sure, Madam Chair.
Would you
Mr. Neely up, please?
Or Pete Shepard, do you want him?
He's not here.
Okay.
He bailed.
I sure wish he was.
He signed up and then he left. That is very bad form. Very bad form.
I signed up for him.
And a little bit of premature optimism, I think.
I feel so shrimpy over here.
Welcome to your own committee, Senator Walker. Mr. Shepard, you are just in time.
Well,
get out the bill folder.
You signed up when you weren't here.
I'm sorry to be delayed now.
Okay, Senator Walker is going to introduce this, and then
I am, and I'm actually looking for the bill, Madam Chair, and I bet
Madam Chair, I happen to have a copy with me.
I thought you might. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator from District 7, and thank you. It's in here somewhere. I didn't expect you to take this bill up right at first, so I appreciate that.
We like to keep people on their toes,
yeah,
with Senate Judiciary.
Okay, Madam Chair, the reason this bill is here, what's really interesting is that when I had Senate Bill 372 in front of you a couple of weeks ago, I heard rumors that, Vicki's introducing that bill because of the Goldschmidt stuff. And there might be rumors that Senate Bill 324 is the same thing. But you know what, Madam Chair? Both those bills didn't come from that case. Both those bills came out of some excellent reporting by an Oregonian about the sex abuse at the Oregon State Hospital. There were a series of articles done by Michelle Roberts. I was over at the coast reading my Sunday Oregonian, and I read about these cases, and I was just appalled. I called Kevin Neely on his cell phone. He always straps it on his hip because he knows I'm going to call him anytime, day or night, and he actually was in Washington, D.C. at the time. Excuse me. And I said, oh, my gosh, Kevin, does the Attorney General allow this to happen? So let me tell you a little bit about this case. Ward 40 is this infamous place at the Oregon State Hospital. There were a series of abuses to children who were housed there that went on for a number of years. Senate Bill 372 to increase mandatory reporting was introduced because of that. And if you notice on that bill, Senator Abel Gordley is my co-sponsor because I called her outraged, knowing how much she cares about mental illness and the protection of people in our state hospital. So Senator Gordley signed on to Senate Bill 372. As I read the articles, I was shocked to read that in one case, the Gonzalez case, the state of Oregon paid an additional $50,000 to secure the silence of a victim whose attorney was ready to hold a news conference on the Marion County courthouse steps. A lawyer in the office, and I'm going to quote this from the newspaper, a lawyer in the office of then Attorney General Ted Kulongoski told a judge in a closed-door hearing that the secrecy was needed to protect the hospital from political attack by the legislature. Madam Chair, there were abuses going on at the state hospital for years, all through the administration of Barbara Roberts, John Kitzhaber, and Neil Goldschmidt prior to that. No one knew about these. I don't know why. They weren't reported by the mandatory reporters that were required to report, and these children kept being admitted into the hospital and sexually abused by the staff. This woman sued the state of Oregon, Ms. Gonzalez. She sued them for a lot of money, The state decided they were going to defend themselves and go to court. And about 3 days into the trial, they realized they were dead in the water, that this woman had a great case. And that's when the $50,000 settlement was offered. Now, that infuriated me. So I contacted Mr. Neely. I said, does the Attorney General allow this to happen? He said, well, I can't speak for the Attorney General back then, who was Ted Kulongoski, but I can speak for the Attorney General now. He would know about those things. And my comments are in here, and we'll let Mr. Shepard talk about that. So I said, well, this has got to stop. This has got to change, because how is the legislature supposed to know what state government is doing wrong if we allow state government to enter into confidentiality agreements, whether it be about sex abuse at the state hospital, whether it be about anything at OIA or any other state agency? So I went to legislative counsel, and I talked to Dave Hendricks. And Dave Hendricks wrote the law that was changed, I think, back in the 90s. And he looked at the law and he says, wow, that's an exception big enough to drive a truck through. And I said, then fix the truck. I do not want an exception for the state to enter into confidentiality agreements any longer. So, Madam Chair, that's why you have Senate Bill 324. And I contacted Mr. Neely, asked him to run it by the Attorney General, Hardy Myers, and there is no problem with this bill, other than the amendment that you see before you, and Mr. Shepard will be able to speak to that.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 324 and to briefly touch on the Dash 1 amendments. The policy at the Department of Justice is and has been, I think, ever since I joined the department in 1987, so going back several attorneys general, that settlements of lawsuits are not to be confidential. And that has been the operating assumption and instructions for assistant attorneys general. As I say, certainly that was true throughout the time that I've been with the department. Indeed, we've conducted as thorough a search as we're able, which I think is pretty thorough, and I think we're able to assure the committee that during Attorney General Myers' tenure, there has not been a settlement that has been held confidential in any way. We support Senate Bill 324 and the proposition in it. We believe the policy of the state ought to be that settlement agreements should not be confidential any more than any other significant matter involving the state's resources should be confidential, except to the extent that there may be an obligation, for example, under federal law to maintain the confidentiality of some part of the settlement agreement. And even then, the confidentiality should only go to that part of the settlement that is required to be held confidential. As you probably know, under the public records law, as a model, the public records law provides a variety of exceptions, but also provides that an agency that relies upon one of those exceptions to withhold any information is supposed to simply redact the information that is subject to the exemption and to disclose the remainder of the document. Similarly, if in those rare cases, and indeed in the last 8 years, the unknown case, but in those rare cases in which federal law does impose some obligation to keep some aspect of the settlement confidential, then our suggestion in the Dash 1 amendments is that only that portion of the settlement be held confidential and the remainder be non-confidential. The other provision in the Dash 1 amendments that you have before you is a provision that would permit the court to determine if it made written findings that the specific privacy interests of a person under the age of 18 outweigh the public's interest in the terms of and conditions of the settlement or compromise. And although I'm not sure that it's completely captured in the Dash 1 amendments, again, the principle that we would recommend to the committee would be that much of the settlement agreement that tends to identify the individual in question, that much should be redacted or removed before anyone would be free to release it, and only that much, so that it wouldn't extend a blanket of confidentiality to the entire settlement agreement. So, for example, a settlement agreement that fell within the terms of that second exception by a determination of a judge would be disclosable to the extent of the amount of the settlement or other terms and conditions that might be imposed on the state institution in question, but simply wouldn't disclose the identity of the particular individual. Again, that would be pursuant to an order of the court, not a judgment that the Attorney General or the plaintiff's attorney or anybody else involved in the case made independently without judicial intervention.
Would you anticipate that with that wording that courts would generally protect the identities of the actual person involved, the actual person under 18 involved?
Madam Chair, I actually think that it would not, the general rule, if I were a judge looking at this language, I would not conclude that the general rule would be that those identities would be exempt. Rather, I would include that they are exempt only if there's a specific privacy interest. For example, if the person, the juvenile involved had already been identified publicly in connection with a particular case.
Okay.
If I were a trial judge looking at this, it would be hard for me to conclude that person had an ongoing specific privacy interest that would require the settlement of the case that already had been reported, for instance.
Right, but in a case where, cause it's pretty much the procedure of the media, for example, not to name the victims of rape, whether they're children or adult victims, and I'm just wondering if this provides adequate protection for victims in this case.
Madam Chair, this as Ash 1 amendments were drafted, it would only apply to persons under the age of 18. So if the person were 19, the judge would not have authority under this subsection to order that person's identity be withheld. So in that instance, the Dash 1 amendments would fall short of the protection that you're describing. As to persons under 18, certainly the fact that a person under 18 who had been the subject of a rape or other sexual assault conceivably could give rise to a specific privacy interest that would cause a judge to order it to be confidential.
I'm just wondering if Senator Walker might be interested in making this language a little bit more directive to protect the identity of victims, since that's really not what you're talking about in these settlements. You're not really, from a public policy standpoint, I don't see anything to be gained by naming victims. What you want to name is the perpetrators.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I would be agreeable to making an adjustment in that regard because you're right. I'm not interested in naming a victim. I'm interested in getting to the facts and making sure that we, as members of the legislature and other Oregonians, have accountability and understand why the state is entering into a confidentiality agreement. I think it's critically important for us to know that. You can redact the name of a victim if you wish, but I don't want to redact all the circumstances around the case because otherwise this bill wouldn't get us anywhere.
Well, and also it would seem to me that maybe redacting the name, but not the age, not the circumstances, you know, of the person. In other words, for somebody who actually knew the victim, you might be able to tell who it was. But for the public at large, it would be enough. I mean, I think the age would be very appropriate to disclose in a lot of these cases because that really goes to the seriousness of the matter. So I don't know, Mr. Shepard, maybe you could tell us, could this language be retooled to accomplish that? I think we all know what we ought to do, and do you think you could do that?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to work with Senator Walker and the committee staff to adjust lines 22 to 24 on page 1 of the Dash 1 amendments plus lines 1 and 2 on the second page. I think that's where the changes would be required.
Senator Walker, I'll look for guidance from you, but I I see why you were especially concerned about someone under 18, but I don't think that really, you know, I think victims who are over 18 also have legitimate reasons, unless, of course, they've been in the media or whatever. Mm-hmm. So maybe it could be turned around that they'd be redacted unless the court found that they, you know, their names would be redacted unless the court found that it was in the public interest not to redact. Maybe you could just turn it around.
Madam Chair, can I ask you a question in that regard? Mm-hmm. Are you interested in protecting the identity of sex abuse victims or all victims?
Well,
of any crime?
Primarily sex abuse.
Okay.
Because that's, you know, that's an area where we have a lot of tradition in this state. I mean, the media does not give the names of sex abuse victims, regardless of their age, you know, rape victims, et cetera, except under, you know, unusual circumstances.
Madam Chair, I would indicate that in the Oregonian article that was September 19th, the first set of those articles, the reporter states, the Oregonian does not identify victims of sex crimes. However, some of the women who were abused as children on Ward 40 have asked that their first or full names be published because they want the abuse brought to light. So the women gave permission, and then the only way the Oregonian was able to discover there was a settlement agreement, this confidentiality agreement, was that the records were supposed to be sealed. But they were accidentally put into some public records at the Marion County Courthouse. So we would have never known had the Oregonian not gone and uncovered that
particular case. But I assume that's right. What this bill is about, is that this has to be public.
Absolutely.
And I don't see anything in here, regardless of how it's worded, that would prevent a victim from coming forward and saying, mm-hmm. I want to be identified. They can do that now. I mean, right. Rape victims can do that now.
Well, Madam Chair, with your leave, then, I would work with Mr. Shepherd and have some amendment drafted that would give protection to those victims of sex crimes, both male and female, from having their names printed and it would be redacted. But other than that, are you satisfied with where we're going with the bill?
Absolutely. Other members of the committee, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Walker, I apologize for coming in late. You probably explained this, but I'm curious to know what it is you're trying to fix.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, Madam Chair started the committee right away. Senator Beyer, this is related to the sex abuse cases that occurred at the Oregon State Hospital that were uncovered by the Oregonian. The reporter, Michelle Roberts, uncovered a series of sex abuse cases over a number of years, and in one particular instance, the woman was offered a $50,000 confidential, an additional $50,000 on top of the $300,000 settlement to keep quiet about the case. And as I quoted to members of the committee, a lawyer in the office of then Attorney General Ted Kulongoski told the judge in a closed-door hearing that the secrecy was needed to protect the hospital from political attack by the legislature. So, Senator Beyer, we were kept in the dark about these abuses that were going on at the state hospital because the state was able to enter into a confidentiality agreement that kept this woman quiet. And I cannot say that this woman should have accepted that or shouldn't have accepted that. That's for her to decide. But it's for us as Oregonians and as members of this legislature to have accountability in our state government. And we need to know about these agreements. The bill is to ban these confidentiality agreements so that we know. And the discussion we're having here is about redacting and protecting the names of sex crime victims. And I've agreed to that.
Madam Chair.
Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you. The bill specifically relates, as I read it, to two areas, agreements in two areas, ORS 320-260 to 300 and then ORS 294-100. And I was just looking those up to see what they are. And I guess it seems like that pretty much covers everybody. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I guess I'm wondering why we're naming, and that that's current law today, those that it's, you know, schedules that ORS 320, 260, 2300, and the ORS 294.100. That's current law, but as I read those, I looked at those, I'm trying to figure out, I guess, what that means, why that's in there. Can you, can somebody give me some, you know, because that pretty much meant everybody as I read it.
And I'm sure, Senator Byer, those are in generic terms, those are the statutes that authorize lawsuits against public bodies. So essentially it's most everybody who would bring an action against the state.
And but it also, the 294-100, isn't that local governments?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, I'm not certain.
We're getting a nod from the League of Oregon Cities, Senator Byer.
That's what I just looked up, and I thought that was, I mean, like I said, this, it looks to me like it's everybody, because I thought maybe it was, this was going to narrow the scope, but it looked to me like it was everybody.
I'm sure, Senator Byer, in the sense of everybody in terms of who the defendant, whom the defendants would be, which governmental entities.
Yes.
Yeah, it would, 3260 to 3300 would pick up all, basically all lawsuits against the state, and I gather that 294-100 would pick up similar actions against local governments.
Did you have a concern over extending it to local governments? In the
well, I guess that's why I asked the question, what are you trying to fix here? Because that's it. This, where I thought it was going to narrow it by listing two statute, it seemed to make it very encompassing as I read it. And I,
right. If you have concerns, we have somebody from the League of Oregon Cities we could call up. Did you want to do that?
I assume they're going to testify.
Actually, they're not signed up, but they're willing. Would you mind, Senator Walker?
No, I wouldn't mind at all.
Come on up.
I'll just stay put.
And so will you.
Yes, ma'am.
You get to stay there, Mr. Shepherd, but you can put your hat on if you like. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Christy Munson, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I just wanted to clarify a couple things. 294-100 is the statute which imputes personal liability to public officials, both those who serve, I believe, in the state, and correct me if I'm wrong, and local governments. And at this time, we're neutral on the bill. We're definitely not opposed. And I'd be happy to provide any more information if you'd like.
So I guess... to narrow it down, does it like school board members, uncompensated people like that, city councilors, they would all be affected by this?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, it's my understanding, working from pure memory here, that 294-100 encompasses all public officials, which would be those employed or volunteering or working for in some capacity for a government. And counsel, when he gets a chance, is free to contradict if I'm wrong.
Probably anybody who has to file a statement of economic interest, which we're all working diligently on this week.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is due on Friday.
and Senator Burdick, it's wider than that, even.
Wider than that, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. And these are...
That's my questions, I guess. There may be people that this... is hooking are unintended to be hooked by having 294-100 as just a question maybe, because I think it's everybody. I mean, I don't think there's any.
Madam Chair, I have 294-100 in front of me, and it's unlawful for any public official to expend any monies in excess of the amounts provided by law or for any different purpose than provided by law. I think the operative word here is a public body,
yes.
And that word includes local, state government, includes boards, commissions, and everything else like that. And if I remember correctly, and Pete Shepard, and I know Dave Hendricks know this better than I do, a public official who's operating within the scope of their official duties is covered by, if they lose a lawsuit, that they're covered by the municipal entity or the state government they work for.
And
well.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, two sessions ago we amended a portion of that statute to say that generally we're going to cover somebody acting with the scope of their employment unless they show, and I don't remember the language we used, but some kind of malfeasance or extreme negligence, and then they're on their own in regards to 294-100 liability.
Madam Chair and Senator Byer, we're not doing anything about their liability. We're just saying they can't enter into a confidentiality agreement, which I think is appropriate when you're dealing with public officials.
So if your school board got sued for something,
that they wouldn't be able to keep any settlement of that confidential. And I know we've had settlements in our school district and they have not been kept confidential. But if you have a victim, that's a different matter. Okay, anything anybody else wants to add?
Madam Chair, we look forward to working with Senator Walker and the committee on that subsection B.
Yes, Senator Walker has a wonderful record on protection of victims, and I will look forward to what you produce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. I think it's really important.
Thank you very much for bringing it to us. Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 324. And what do you want to do next?
Do work sessions.
We will open. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 198 for purposes of. We don't even need to hear this, do we?
We had a hearing on the bill.
Yeah, we will move this over to next Thursday.
Tomorrow's fine.
Till tomorrow. Senate Bill 198 will be carried to tomorrow, close work session. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 243. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Senate Bill 243 was before the committee for a public hearing on February 7th. The bill would modify the statute that provides for conditions of post-prison supervision and parole to individuals who have been convicted of sex crimes. The current provision states that such an individual is prohibited from frequenting places where minors are likely to congregate. The provision embodied in this measure would change the word frequenting to being present at, therefore effectively making the prohibition against any sex offender from being present at a place where children are likely to congregate. At our public hearing, members of the committee raised concerns about the potential vagueness and overbreadth of the suggested change, and in response to that, Legislative Council has proposed a dash 2 amendment at the direction of the committee, which should be in your packet. There was a dash 1 amendment that was drafted earlier, and that has been supplanted by the dash 2. I'm taking a moment to make sure you have it.
Okay, and I don't think we have one, and Council and I discussed this earlier, and
and there may be good reason to go for a dash 3.
Yes, I don't think we're yet there. Why don't you just give us a sense of the dash 2 amendment and
sure.
where we want to head
sure.
instead.
The proposed dash 2 essentially left the frequenting language as is. So that is to say that any sex offender would be prohibited from frequenting a place where minors are likely to congregate. But it would add another section that would be specific to sex offenders for whom the conviction was against a minor, and it would prevent that category of individuals from being present at or near a school, playground, or daycare, or other place very similar like that intended for use by children. Now, another concept that Senator Burdick and I discussed this morning in response to some concerns that were expressed from parole and post-prison supervision officers to the concept of the dash 2 is another alternative that would apply to every sex offender, and it would be that any sex offender may not be present near or at a school, playground, or daycare, and may not frequent places, that is, other places where children are likely to congregate. The benefit of that proposal is that the parole and probation folks don't need to differentiate between the offenders who have been convicted of crimes against minors and the offenders who have been convicted of crimes against adults, and all sex offenders would be prohibited from being present at schools, playgrounds, daycare centers, at or near. That goes to the case, the Court of Appeals case that this original proposal was really in response to, yet it leaves the frequenting provision as to any other place where children are likely to congregate, giving, you know, which is essentially what the provision is now.
Are you comfortable with that, Senator Prezansky? Because this all came about because of your concerns that the original was overly broad.
Madam Chair, it does sound like it's more in line with what we were discussing, making sure that we gave some specificity to the language and making sure that everyone understands what the prohibitions would be and making sure that we weren't setting ourselves up for a challenge.
Thank you. Are there other members of the committee with comments or direction? Because I think we will move forward with a Dash 3 amendment. Not try to do that today.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I do want to point out Michael Washington from the Parole Board is here, as well as the bill that I spoke with this morning who is also involved with these issues. I apologize. I don't have your name in front of me. But I think that this concept that I'm calling the Dash 3 was in response to some of their concerns, and I'm not sure what, if any, response they have to this concept.
Maybe we could just have somebody from the Parole Board come up, and if they're here in the room, and give a nod or a thumbs down or a cheer or whatever is appropriate here. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Washington, current Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And the concern that the board had with Senate, the amendments, as just stated by Mr. O'Leary, were that the purpose of having the frequenting the places where minors are likely to congregate was to give the supervising officers an opportunity to designate certain places that weren't normally intended for minors to be congregated as places that persons that were convicted of sex offenses not to go to at all. Like, for example, if there were a corner sandlot that no one attended, and then children in the neighborhood started going there to play. If the sex offender were to go there, that would give the opportunity of the supervising officer to designate that place for the offender not to go to. And at that point in time, if the offender were to go there, then they would be subject to violation of these conditions. If the frequenting language remains for those types of places, that would give the offender the opportunity to go to such a place as many as three times before the board or the supervising officer could respond to their presence there. And that would be a problem.
Okay, so if we could phrase it in, you know, schools, daycares, or other locations frequented solely by children. I mean,
Madam Chair, if I could.
Please.
Mr. Washington, I mean, I'm trying to conceptually understand what that means, because you put that in the order. People need to have some understanding of how we define a place where it frequently occurs. One of the things, if you didn't hear the tapes, are we saying that these individuals will never be able to go to a public library because there might be a children's section where you expect kids to go to do some work? I mean, I can understand saying you can't go into the children's section of the public library, but if we're saying that you can't go to the institution because there possibly will be kids coming in there for whatever purpose, I'm having a little difficult time understanding how we define and we actually insulate ourselves from a challenge of something being too broad and vague. I mean, clearly we want to protect children, but we need to make certain we have sideboards on what this means.
I guess I'm concerned in the proposed language. My name is Darcy Baker. I'm a member of the Parole Board, and prior to becoming a member of the board, I spent 25 years as a probation and parole officer in Clackamas County, the last 10 years supervising sex offenders. And so I'm concerned about any language that would open the doors for the offenders to go where children congregate or that exists for the primary enjoyment of minors. When the go-to language was proposed, it was a means of just narrowing it down for the offender and responding to the Brundage lawsuit. we're frequenting was just too vague. Parole and probation officers, as part of their orientation with offenders, review with them the places that they can and cannot go. And I always used to say, this is not an all-encompassing list. You know, this gives you an idea. But if children are going there, you need to, you know, minimize the times that you're going there so children are not there primarily, such as the grocery store. You know, because you could encounter children at the grocery store. You could encounter them at the library. But no, they shouldn't be in the children's section.
So. Well, Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, to follow up on that, the practice for the supervising officer as it relates to the offender, if the offender were to go into the children's section or to the public library and went to the children's section, they would not be sanctioned immediately for their presence there for that one time. If they were to go back, now that they are aware that this is where children are going to be and they were to go back, the proposed amendment by the board would allow supervising officers to be able to sanction them at that time. But if the frequenting language were to remain there, once they would go there and then they would learn that children were now congregating at that part of the library, then they would go again, and that would be considered a first time, and then that would allow them, the board would only be able, or the supervising officer would only be able to respond to that if they were to go then yet another time. And if you have that, a sex offender going around victims of around people that are the age of their victims that many times, you're setting up an opportunity for someone else to be victimized.
Counselor, did you have something to add to that?
Madam Chair, thank you. My immediate thought is that if it is written the way it is now with frequenting, which has been interpreted to mean more than once, so if there's evidence that a person was at the place and it is a place where children go and they went back, that the second time is the time you can violate them as the probation officer or as the court. So the concept that we discussed as the -3 would keep that as to places where children are likely to congregate, but would create a more strict level for the enumerated places, the school, the daycare. One shot is a violation.
Okay, because I'm thinking, and that's a good point, I'm thinking we may be able to maybe expand the enumeration a little bit by saying something like, you know, schools, daycares, or locations specifically designated for children. That would certainly take in the children's section of the library. It would take in the wading pool at the rec center, you know, things specifically designated. Senator Prozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Washington, I guess I'm just, again, I understand, it sounds to me that there's I'm going to call it a release plan that's set up with the offender, and is it correct that the P&P officer is sitting down with that individual and saying, these are the places that you're being prohibited, and there's something that's in writing that they understand that? Because one of the things that was discussed is the arbitrariness of having someone not being on notice as to where those areas are. Of course, there's obvious ones, as we've talked about here, but there's others that may not be. And it only seems that you would need to provide some type of notice before you actually act. And if you're telling us that there is a plan, they understand that these 8 places have been designated by the probation officer as being a place where kids are most likely to frequent, I can live with that. But I'm not sure exactly what the policy is and the procedure. Again, we just need to make sure that we're working on the same page, that everyone understands what you can do and what you can't do, and give your officers as much latitude as we can. But I think if you just leave it open, it's going to make it much more vulnerable to a challenge.
We'll take that.
I understand what you're saying. You know, however, I'm very concerned about not having it as open as possible to limit where offenders can go and have contact with children.
The dash threes, from what I've heard, is going to take care of that. It's going to leave the frequenting language in. It's also going to designate specific areas that we know are going to be off limits. And you basically, on the frequently, you're going to have your procedure that you use, mm-hmm. and the other's going to say, if you go into this, you've caused a penalty point, and you're out. And so I'm trying to figure out why. What else do we need to give you that's not being provided in the dash threes?
Chair Burdick, Senator Prezansky, I again, coming from a PO, changing it to being present at, I think, eliminates those ambiguities that an offender may try to take advantage of.
Well, yeah, but what Senator Prezansky pointed up at our very first hearing that you could have somebody at the mall and a class could come through, and if they're present, you know, they're
right.
stuck. So,
right.
you know, we've got to, you're not going to be able to deal with every situation. We have to have clarity. What we could do, and I'd be interested in your opinions, Mr. Senator Prezansky and counsel, is maybe have a definition of frequenting, which is going back more than once. I mean, if they go once and they find out that kids are there, then they go back a second time. I don't see any point of waiting until a third time, do you?
No, I don't. And the issue, like on the mall, I mean, you can, I mean, I can always imagine you're going to have young people at a mall. And it would make more sense that I probably would see them if they had an arcade at the mall or a movie place where you'd expect them to be more congregating as compared to being a department store. But that's the part that I'm still trying to grasp, is that if you say you can't be at the mall, I think we've just lost that opportunity to disseminate these individuals back in the community without or well, and still not maintain the protections that we're really looking to do.
Chair Burnick, Senator Prezansky, I think that if we could get a definition of what frequenting means put into the statute, that may help. And the reason I was saying that it would allow for a third opportunity before the board would be able to act, because if it's going to places where children are likely to congregate and you have a person going to the, well, to use the initial example, is the library where the children's section is, and they didn't know that that place existed, then there is at that point that they're on notice. And then using the current language as interpreted by the court in the Brundage case, they would have to go right after being put on notice, they would have to go back to it more than once again. That's why I was thinking from a legal standpoint, we would only be able to respond after the third time, which would place children at risk.
We'll take a shot at a definition, and we will do the enumeration. Do you have any more need for direction, counsel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your suggestion is a good one. I looked at this case that we're all talking about, Brundage versus the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and the definition, the interpretation of the word frequent by the Court of Appeals is the plain language interpretation, which is to go to often. So it's not clear from the case that it's more than once. So it would certainly be appropriate to make a legislative statement about what that means.
Okay, appreciate that. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill
243.
And we will, let's see, I see counsel has entered the room. Other counsel, Ms. Moab?
We're over counsel today.
We're over counsel. We are an embarrassment of riches. Thank you very much. Representative Greenleaf was going to come. Do you know what his status is?
Madam Chair, I do not know.
Okay.
Mr. O'Leary informed me that Representative Greenleaf wanted to be here, but I have not heard from his office.
Well, I think we will go ahead and move into a work session on Senate Bill 273, the long-awaited, long-postponed work session, counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the bill that would increase the homestead exemption for judgment debtors from $25,000, which is currently at, to $50,000 for a single debtor, and from $33,000 to $75,000 for joint debtors who are members of the same household. And then the bill would also increase the motor vehicle exemption for a judgment debtor from its current level, $1,700, to $3,000. There are three amendments before you. the Dash 1 amendment would increase the vehicle exemption to $3,000 but leave the homestead exemption unchanged. The Dash 2 amendment would raise the vehicle exemption to $2,150 and increase the homestead to $30,000 for a single debtor and $39,600 for joint debtors. And then finally, the Dash 3 only increases the vehicle exemption and to a level of $2,500.
Well, that was $2,500?
Yes.
So the difference between the Dash 1 and the Dash 3 is how much money?
The difference between the Dash 1 raises, they both only raise the vehicle exemption, leaving the homestead unchanged. The Dash 1 raises it to $3,000.
Right.
The Dash 3 raises it to $2,500, and it is currently $1,700.
And the Dash 2 amendment raises both the vehicle and the
homestead. Correct.
Homestead.
But less than either of the vehicle was actually less than the other two. It was $2,150.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair, can I speak to those amendments?
Please, give us some guidance.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we did have a work group at your direction, and we met on a couple of occasions and couldn't come to an agreement. Surprise, but we made a good faith effort. The only agreement we came to is the credit unions accepted the Dash 2 amendments. After a lot of discussion, we were trying to, your direction to me was to find a legitimate reason to raise it, give us some background on it. So, Madam Chair, I went back in the record, which, you know, I have a penchant for doing, and I absolutely love doing that. So, in 1993, in the legislative session, there was Senate Bill 413. That was 12 years ago. They raised a whole bunch of exemptions back in 1993. They increased the homestead, they increased the auto, they increased clothing, they doubled a number of these exemptions. They increased them tremendously. So then I was, and in the record, what's interesting to note, Madam Chair, is that Mr. Jim Marquis represented the Oregon Collectors Association in 1993, and he was present at the hearing. And Mr. David Niebel, who represented Oregon Legal Services, was present at the hearing in 1993. So it's kind of interesting to read their comments. And they said, well, it's a difficult question, but, you know, we agree with these amendments. So everyone kind of decided, well, it looks like every 12 years we're going to hit on these. So I thought, well, okay, let me look back in the records. So I went back, and I found the last time they increased the exemptions, and that was in 1981, which was 12 years prior to 1993. And basically, this came from archives. This is pretty cool. So I went through, and the arguments were about the same. Well, they talked about cost of living, they talked about why we should raise them, but it always came down to about every 12 years we raise the exemptions.
I just wondered if Mr. Marquis and Mr. Niebel worked there in 1981.
I did not notice that, Senator Prozanski, but I think Mr. Barrows was there.
I think Mr. Marquis actually was there in 1991.
I think he probably was, but I hadn't seen that quite yet in here. But anyway, Madam Chair, we tossed around how would we settle on a way to do this. We researched other states to see if they had a trigger of some kind, and there really wasn't anything out there that we could go on. Some people kind of looked at the cost of living. Basically, it was what you could get all the parties to agree to. Well, in Oregon, it looks like every 12 years we make an adjustment, Madam Chair.
This is the time.
And this is the time. Now, that comes down to the issue of, well, what adjustment are we going to make? Well, the collectors only want to increase the vehicle exemption to $2,500. The consumer folks said, well, $3,000 on the car and nothing else, but the collectors wouldn't agree to that. But I got the credit unions to agree to the Dash 2s. And we chose that that number because it's a 20% increase over the current amounts. And it's only the homestead and only the vehicle. And Madam Chair, I would remind you that on our other committee that in 1993, we increased everything. Huge numbers. Okay, not just little increases, but some are 55%, some are 50%. So all we're asking here is two measly little increases. So I finally gave an ultimatum to the committee. I said, the work group, I said, I'm going to go with the dash twos, and here's the other reason why I chose that. Congress is going to pass the bankruptcy reform bill, Madam Chair. It's been in the making for about 7 years. I think it's going to go to the conference committee, but it's kind of come out of the conference committee. That bankruptcy reform bill has some good things and some very bad things in it. Debtors will not be able to have the kind of opportunities that they have today. There's going to be a real crackdown on their ability to discharge debts. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly tightens the noose around their abilities to get things done. And I reviewed the Bankruptcy Reform Act, and actually the Seattle Times called, was really angry about it and said Congress should be enacting laws or should use the tax code to encourage Americans to get out of debt instead of punishing them for turning to the financial crack cocaine that's found in their mailbox every day. And they refer to credit card offers. The credit card companies have no accountability in the Bankruptcy Reform Act. So, Madam Chair, long-winded explanation is, because the Bankruptcy Reform Act is going to be implemented, I felt that with all of those things, a measly 20% increase in the vehicle and the homestead was justifiable. And it's 12 years, and it's time to do something.
Senator Walker, I really appreciate your research, and I'm renewing my own vow to be very careful of what I do or say when you're in the same room with a panel. And I think from a policy standpoint, it's very hard to justify doing just one. I mean, I think from a political standpoint, it might have some value, but I think you've come up with a reasonable, justifiable thing here. Senator Starr, I will give you first choice on the Dash 2 Amendment. If you decline, I will ask Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 2 Amendments to Senate Bill 273.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 Amendments to Senate Bill 273. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, just kind of, I think Senator Walker did some great research. One of the things that I think is implicit in this is that we're at least trying to match inflation. We're trying to match the cost of living, and although Senator Walker didn't go back and figure out exactly what it would cost to build in an inflation factor, I think it's clear that we're not matching it, particularly on the housing price. I mean, housing in the last 10 years in the Portland metro area has doubled at least. And so I hope we don't wait another 12 years to revisit this. I think that these exemptions are very important for consumers who have financial difficulties to protect their most valuable assets, their house and their car. And so I certainly support the Dash 2 Amendments. I only am disappointed that they're not more aggressive.
Appreciate that, Senator Ringo. Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, I would oppose the Dash 2, and I will oppose the bill. And it's just my belief that the 1993 bill went way too far, and I don't think we should emulate that.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments? Discussion?
Madam Chair, just one final comment from me, if I could. In that the reason I didn't pursue any other changes is because we did add one other exemption two sessions ago, or one session ago, I can't remember, but we added the earned income credit as an exemption under our law. And so we did add one exemption, and I gave a good presentation to the committee on that as to why Congress had enacted the earned income credit, and this legislature passed that. So I feel comfortable with just going forward on these two, and we'll revisit this in another 12 years.
Maybe in another 2 years, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Is there objection? Senator Whitsitt, you are objecting to the Dash 2 Amendments. Okay, why don't you call the roll?
Senator Pruszynski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Beyer, did you want to vote on this, or you just walked in? We can give you a second if you want.
Well, I think I know which ones these are. You know.
I think you're a no.
These are not the work group product.
These are not the same.
This is what it does. This is not the consensus work group product.
Correct. The work group could not agree.
I'm a no.
This is the Senator Vicky Walker. This is the last stand. Amendment.
No, please note two no's on that roll call. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 273 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 273 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So noted. Please call the roll. Thank you.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pozanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Five ayes, two nays.
Bill 273 is adopted. Senator Walker, you can carry that.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank all the members of the work group.
Thank you. Let's see, now we'll go right into Dog Day Afternoon Redo. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 641. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 641 would create the misdemeanor crime of owning or possessing dogfighting paraphernalia with the intent that that paraphernalia be used in furtherance of a dogfight or to train a dog as a fighting dog. There is a -1 amendment before you that would change the definition of fighting pit, one of the things that is listed as dogfighting paraphernalia, to include an area that is walled as opposed to a walled excavation. Excuse the typo in the SMS, by the way. That is a walled area as opposed to a walled excavation. And then there is a -2 amendment that would narrow the definition of unprescribed veterinary medicine, which is also listed as one of the paraphernalia items, to unprescribed veterinary medicine that is a prescription drug as defined by ORS 689.005.
Okay. Council, I recall the these amendments were adopted with the Veterinary Association.
The Chair Burdick was. That's correct.
Okay. Okay, tell me again what the -1 does.
The -1 changes the definition of, and I'm going to look at the original bill to point it out to you, of fighting pit, which is on line 19 of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
The original bill called fighting pit a walled excavation designed to contain a dogfight. And that sentence would be amended. The word excavation would be stricken, and in its place, the word area would be placed.
That's so, I remember, because it sometimes they're adding.
Might not always be an excavated pit, was the testimony. Yeah.
Okay. This bill has been worked over pretty thoroughly. I think it's time to do or die on this bill. So, Senator Starr, we have two amendments that do different things and are probably both necessary to this bill. We have a motion.
Move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 641.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 641. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 641.
Senator Starr has moved the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 641. Discussion? Senator Barr?
Madam Chair, I will oppose this motion. I don't like the bill. So.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Senator, what is your opinion of this amendment? -2.
I would support that amendment.
Okay. Is there any further discussion of the -2? Objection? So noted. Would you call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Excuse me, aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Dash two amendments are adopted. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 641 as amended to the floor with the new pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 641 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Chair Burdick?
Senator Whitsitt?
I want to make sure that it's on the record that the intent that the paraphernalia be used to train a dog as a fighting dog or to be used in the furtherance of a dog fight is clearly delineated, that that intent must be proven prior to someone being convicted of simply having this paraphernalia in their possession.
Appreciate you putting on that on the record, Senator Whitsitt. It would be required under the bill and under criminal law. So appreciate you putting that on the record. Do you have anything to add, counsel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that is absolutely the intent. I think that the plain language of the bill reflects that. The mental state is clear that there needs to be intent for those items to be used. Possession of the items in and of themselves is not a criminal offense.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, objections? Okay. Senator Beyer objects. Please call the roll. Thank you.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? No. Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Senate Bill 64 is adopted. I will ask Senator Deckert to carry this bill, and if he declines,
no.
I will carry it.
He'll carry it.
You think so?
Oh, I know it.
Do you have inside knowledge, Senator Brzezinski?
Oh, yeah. I talked to him on the floor about these things. It's a dog's day for him.
Dog day afternoon. Okay. Well, continuing dog day afternoon, we will open a work session. I still don't see Representative Greenlink, so we will open a work session on Senate Bill 844. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 844 is a little more complicated. There's a proposed -1 amendment that replaces entirely the text of the original bill. There is also a -2 amendment that does everything that the -1 amendment does except for one difference. The only difference between the two is the mental state for purposes of the misdemeanor offenses that are created in both. In the -1, the mental state is criminal negligence by operation of a separate statute that says when no mental state is specified in a criminal statute outside the criminal code, the mental state is criminal negligence. That is how this statute has previously read. The -2 amendment has a different mental state, a knowing mental state, which is a slightly higher burden of proof for the prosecution. Everything else in the -1 and the -2 are exactly the same. What both of these amendments do is they create factors that would be used to determine whether a dog is a potentially dangerous dog or a dangerous dog. It creates definitions for each. It creates a judicial process for the determining of each. And it creates penalties for the keeping of a dangerous dog or not following conditions placed on a keeper of a dangerous dog. The misdemeanor offense is created for a second violation. I'm going to have to double check here and make sure I'm saying this right. A second violation for violating the conditions imposed on the keeper of a potentially dangerous dog, or a second violation of the conditions imposed on a dangerous dog. The first violation for both is a Class B violation, that is an infraction, no possibility of jail. Second violation, Class C misdemeanor. Under the -1, the violation can be proven with criminal negligence. Under the -2, the violation may be proven with a knowing mental state.
So just to clarify for us, the -2 amendment would create a higher bar for finding someone guilty.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Is Marcia Keith in the audience? I don't know if you're our source on this. If you want to come forward, if there are any questions, I think it's pretty, the council's summary has been excellent on this. I know a lot of people have worked very hard to get this one in shape. It's quite different from the original bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Deckard's assistant is also in the office, who I think was instrumental in putting this together.
I was looking for her. There she is. She's hiding. Okay, come on.
She always hides in the back.
Come on, Susie. This is your time here. Susie, why don't you identify yourself for the record and just tell us where this Dash 2 amendment came from.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susie Funkhauser. I'm Senator Deckard's legislative assistant. I think the Dash 1 amendment, the Dash 2 amendment, I should say, was just something that Joe O'Leary and I spoke about, and I think everyone in the work group is okay with the Dash 1s, but if you'd like to describe a mental state, the Dash 2 amendment is also okay with the work group. So,
thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So, committee, the Dash 2 amendments would create a higher level of finding of criminal intent to make a conviction, and I am personally more comfortable with that, although feel free to argue a lower standard if you want. Senator Pisanski?
Not argue the lower standard. I'm just wondering why in the Dash 1s we were relying on bootstrapping to the other definition for what the raise means would be as compared to just saying it would be criminal negligence.
Counsel?
Was there a reason for that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pisanski, I believe that there is already a misdemeanor offense that is on the books for a second offense of one of these, but I'm not absolutely sure. I'd want to double check. And what I noticed was that the bill created two offenses. I noticed that the mental state was not enumerated, and at the last hearing on this on the 7th, I pointed out that that might be a problem. In talking to legislative counsel, they pointed out to me the existence of the separate statute that imputes the criminal negligence mental state. So I think that there is an argument that would go, it was criminal negligence before when it was one misdemeanor. Now it's two misdemeanors. It can still be criminal negligence. And there could also be an argument that a higher mental state should be required to be proven as well.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, under current law, without passing any bill, if a dog bites someone, attacks someone, doesn't it that the dog, there are statutes there that say what's supposed to happen or allow the county governing boards to decide how that dog is going to be treated, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe so. I'm not familiar with this area of law as I am with some others, and if you have specific questions like that one, I want a few moments to consult with the statute and make sure I got it right before I answered you definitively.
Maybe Marcia Keith could address that. Do you know the answer to that, Marcia or Susie?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I do not know the answer to that.
Senator Pisanski.
I can only refer to what they do in Lane County when there's that type of situation that occurs. The ordinances in the county set up the procedure for the county officials to determine, whoever the animal control person is, what is going to be done with that dog as to what type of level of sanctions and what type of requirements will be placed on the owner. So maybe on a county basis, I don't know of anything in the state law that actually sets the procedure, but I think that's been pretty much at the local level.
No.
Okay, Council?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe I found the answer, which is located in ORS 609-097. There is a Class C misdemeanor created under current law if the keeper of the dog, bites a person, and the keeper is adjudicated as maintaining a public nuisance, and the keeper has been previously convicted of a violation of keeping a dog that is a public nuisance. That is currently a Class C misdemeanor under current law. There's no mental state enumerated, which means by operation of this separate statute. It's criminal negligence.
Senator Byer. Does that answer your question?
It does, Madam Chair, and I think so. And I think Senator Pozanski is also correct that there's also counties are free to do what they want to do on these issues until they get to that area.
If I could, Madam Chair, the county stuff deals with the animal and how it's going to be classified.
Yes, and how it's
and what Larry's talked about is more the how the individual that keeps it. So they work together. But it appears to me that if we're wanting to make certain that we have a standard that the person has knowledge of it, et cetera, you take the dash twos, or you would have the higher standard of knowingly, because at this point it would be the lower threshold of just criminal negligence.
Yeah, on the second violation.
Okay. Discussion? Senator Whitted?
This morass of amendments. Under a potentially dangerous dog is the following. Any dog which, when unprovoked, engages in a behavior that requires a defensive action by any person to prevent bodily injury, et cetera, while chasing or menacing off the property of the owner or keeper. Section has any dog which, unprovoked, causes an injury to a person that is less severe than a serious injury. It says nothing in that section. I don't see where it says anything in that section about being off the property of the owner or chasing or menacing. It just says this could be someone's, could be construed as someone's picking these, biting you in the front yard, you know, which peaks often do.
Madam Chair, if I could direct the committee to the section of the bill. I'll direct the committee to the section of the dash one amendment. It's on page 2 at line 5.
How about the dash 2? Can you work from the dash 2 since that would
sure.
be the same on that
yeah,
one?
No problem. Yeah. I think it'll be in the same place actually. Mm-hmm. Dash 2, page 2, line 5, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is the definition of a potentially dangerous dog.
And while not on property.
And I think that the section that Senator Witz is pointing to is sub B. And while sub A mentions while not on the property from which the keeper may lawfully exclude others, and sub C mentions while not on the property from which the keeper may lawfully exclude others, I think he's absolutely correct that sub B does not have that same limitation. And I can't, not being a member of the work group, I cannot speak to whether or not that was an intentional omission or not.
That looks like an oversight to me because you're, well, let's see. Yeah, because it's, I don't know, though. Susie, do you have any insight on that, why that was left out?
Because
what you're saying is that even if it's in the owner's yard, it would be fall under that definition. Did you have a comment?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think one thing that was brought up is there's exemptions to a classification of a potentially dangerous or dangerous dog, and one of those is if there's a trespasser on your own property or something like that, that those dogs would be exempt from being classified, something like that. So I think in this case, where it can be classified a potentially dangerous or dangerous dog is, for instance, mail carriers or something of that nature, that they're just trying to deliver the mail, and if the dog is on the person's property and attacks the individual, I think that's where there could be a classification, but it's obviously up to the judge or the hearing officer to make that determination. That answers
Sir,
the question.
Well, this gets to be interesting because I've been around dangerous dogs a few times and had the occasion to visit a farmer's home because I wanted to pick his sweet corn. And as I got out of my truck, Dover...
The dog was defending his property against you, Senator Stark.
The Doberman Pinscher stood between me and the kitchen door, and we had a talk, and I got back in the truck and drove away. But later on the road, I saw this farmer, and he said, "I saw you come in the yard." He said, "My dog won't bite." So the next day, I go back, and I get out of my truck, and here I'm confronted by the same dog, and I said, "Easy, boy," and he just jumped over real easy and bit me quite severely in the thigh.
Oh.
And jumped back, and about that time, the door opened, and the owner, not seeing that, said, "Come on in, he won't bother you."
We may have a new Dash Amendment here.
I believe that we've done a pretty good job cleaning this up. I see that there is inflicts injury on or kills domestic livestock. In my years on the farm, I have seen dogs that running at large, when accompanied by another dog, act like a pack of dogs and killed sheep or goats or attacked livestock. I think it's important that we have protections against that reoccurring. The owner is aware that his dog has attacked livestock. We need to take action. This is a bill that gives me some consternation, but on the other hand, I think that we've had so many reported cases of dog attacks. I think it's useful that we have some statute to provide guidance to counties and others who would deal with these on a more direct basis. So I'm going to be supporting the Dash 2 amendments and move this bill forward if that's the will of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Starr. I appreciate your comments. And, you know, the situation you described is precisely subsection B. You were on the property. That dog inflicted bodily injury, which, thank heavens, was less severe than the serious bodily injury, although it probably didn't feel that way at the time. And so I think it looks to me like it was intentional to have that level of injury to a person. It was intentional to have that not apply only to places outside the owner's property. The postman, the pizza delivery person, the corn picker, if you will. Mm-hmm. Senator Starr. Senator Ringo.
Well, I'd like to tell a story, too, if I could.
Please do. This is Dog Day Afternoon. All stories are welcome.
I didn't get bit by the dog. My client did. My client owned the dog who did. I represented a fellow who owned a tow yard and had his Rottweiler had bit somebody three times. And so what happened is, there was about 30 signs around that say, "Do not enter, beware a dog, don't go here." And people would wander in and walk, because there was a small door, and we wandered around looking for the car. And in this case, the fellow walked right up to within the Rottweiler was secured, walked within range of the Rottweiler. So the Rottweiler got to the end of the chain and was still able to bite this person. And I just put that in a different category. I mean, the person had done a lot to try to warn the public. The dog was secured. It's definitely a dangerous dog. From my client's perspective, he needed security, and the police were not adequate. And frankly, I haven't had time to read the Dash 2s in detail, but I do think we need to be careful in terms of somebody that's made an effort to secure their dog, warn the public about it. Somehow that needs to be addressed in this. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd ask the committee council how would this law operate under those that set of facts.
I think that, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that there's certainly a potentiality that under sub 3B
that's on line 10, page 2 of the dash 2, that the only thing I can think of to accept liability, if you will, under that section is if somebody's breaking into the tow yard, that could be considered provocation. And that passage says without provocation, the dog inflicts bodily injury. But that could be construed as a stretch.
But wouldn't it be construed as provocation if someone disregarded a sign that there was a dangerous dog?
I don't know, Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, I don't know if that would be provocation so much as it would be failure to heed a warning. I'm not sure.
Senator Meyer.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, and I guess for counsel or somebody. But in that instance, I mean, Senator Ringel said that the way I understood the story, that was the third offense of that particular dog. So
that's
that
right.
Dog, not only he's
a repeat offender.
He's been chained.
Three strikes and you're out.
His entire is enclosed, so he's not being provoked. But that instantly kicks him up from a potentially dangerous dog, where I think this is working, to a dangerous dog, which increases the liability that the owner would have then at that point in time because he's already committed an offense once. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that is correct. And I think that the definition of dangerous dog would also include a dog that has committed any of the paragraphs listed under a potentially dangerous dog more than once. So it could get you there quickly.
Senator Whitson.
I still am hung up on this, and we're discussing it, but on Section 3B, that without provocation, if it's bodily injury to a person that is less severe than serious bodily injury, without saying, we can't write any legislation that I can support that outlaws guard dogs. And you should be able, from a rural area, sometimes it's important that you do have something that people might think that the ordinary person from the city might think was menacing. I'm not saying that that dog should be allowed to run out in the open, but you have to be able to keep keep your dog that you want to on your own private property. And this without this, I
a dog fight.
should we recite the calico cat and the gingham dog, or however that went?
Oh, I don't find it now, but I thought that we had within this provisions for dogs that were guard dogs, providing some exclusion for guard dogs and being enclosed in the
actually you can kind of go in reverse because they can release it from impound if it's posted and they're confined, so it's kind of a backwards thing on page 3. Susie, do you have any elucidation of that?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm looking, at the dash ones, but I think it's the same line on page 1, line 13 of page 1. It says, subsection 2 of this section does not apply if a dog causes physical injury to a person wrongfully assaulting the dog or the dog's keeper or to a person who trespasses upon premises from which the keeper may lawfully exclude others.
There's two?
Yeah. So,
on section 1.
So that would actually be a trespass, Charlie. I think you're, Senator Ringo, you're, that would be a trespass if it was posted.
Okay. That's only dealing with section 1 of the bill, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that is section 1, subsection 3, and it applies to subsection 2 of the bill, which is the definition of dangerous and potentially dangerous dog.
I'm reading that it requires a subsection 2 of this section.
Mm-hmm. Well.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's right.
Yes.
Wait a second, Bill. Yeah. Well, I think the clear intent is for that to apply to Section 2. Is that correct?
I think Senator Byer has it right. That is modified by subsection 2 of section 1, which is the strict liability for economic damages caused by physical injury caused by a dog. So as to the strict liability for civil purposes, that does not apply if the physical injury was caused to a person who was trespassing on the premises that the keeper could lawfully exclude others. It is not written in a way that makes it applicable, at least in this section, to Section 2, which is the dangerous dog and potentially dangerous dog.
Okay. Susie, I think it would be within the intent of this to apply it to Section 2. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We definitely do not want to make guard dogs that on private property subject to this at all.
Committee, are we all comfortable with that being done on this?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
We're solving your client's problem.
You mean sending it back to get a further amendment?
Yes. Okay. Work session is closed on 8:44. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 945 by popular demand. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 945, and you'll have the -3 amendments in front of you, which basically replaces the bill. It comes to you responsive to behalf of the committee on the judiciary at the request of Blair Halpern. And what the bill does, it prohibits a court from reinstating spousal maintenance if the court terminated spousal maintenance because of remarriage of the spouse receiving the spousal maintenance.
Okay, we have Blair Halpern signed up here. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Blair Halperin. I'm a physician in Portland. I'd much rather be talking to you about some health care policy issue, but I'm here today to talk to you in support of Senate Bill 945 and specifically the -3 amendments. The difference between the two is the -2 amendment had a retroactive clause, and I'll speak to that during the course of testimony. I think it's important to have some background idea of spousal support law in Oregon. In 1977, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that spousal support does not automatically terminate upon remarriage of the spouse receiving support. And in 1987, they further defined it by saying that when deciding whether to terminate support, the courts must evaluate whether the purposes of the initial support have been met. Now, prior to 1991, once a decision was made to terminate spousal support, there was no mechanism for its reinstatement. In 1991, legislation was introduced at the request of an attorney here in Salem, Paul Saucy, to permit reinstatement of spousal support. And that led to passage of ORS 107.136, which stated that whenever spousal support has been terminated under ORS 107.135, that the court has the power to order reinstatement of the support obligation if the basis for termination ceases to exist.
Mr. Halper, if I can break in for just a second, we are running very short of time, and there's another work session we have to have before 3. So could you, we have your written statement on the record. If you could just summarize that very quickly, that'd be
great. I was hoping I was doing that. Sorry. I'll try and summarize further. So briefly, the court subsequent to that classified different types of support, breaking it down to compensatory support, transitional support, and maintenance support. Compensatory support for that type of support that's provided to a spouse who has contributed to the career of the payor, the obligor, transitional to help the recipient spouse gain experience to enhance her own, his or her own income, and maintenance to provide a level of, a standard of living similar to that experienced or enjoyed during the marriage. Now, in most states, including Oregon and Washington, including Washington and California, support does terminate automatically upon remarriage. And I realize that that would be a great deviation from Oregon's historical perspective. However, I personally believe that maintenance support, once it has been terminated due to the active and voluntary act of the receiving party, in this instance by a remarriage, where it was determined by the courts that support was no longer necessary, that it's hard to believe that the legislature ever intended to allow the previously receiving party to have essentially a second bite at the apple should he or she decide to end their second marriage. Once maintenance has been terminated, due to determination that remarriage of the receiving spouse obviates the need for such support, I can see no reason why support should be reinstated if they elect to divorce their second spouse. It essentially allows a once receiving party to elect which spouse they want to come back to receive support. And in fact, in the second divorce, the receiving spouse might choose to not seek maintenance support from their second spouse, possibly in exchange for some other benefit. When I reviewed and when others have reviewed the legislative minutes from 1991 hearings, it was very obvious that it was never the intention of the legislature to allow reinstatement of support following a divorce or second divorce. Mr. Saucy provided examples, and one example included a rebound marriage that occurred after a 30-year marriage. Support had been terminated, and then the rebound marriage failed a couple of years later. And Mr. Saucy initially said that support should be allowed. The legislators felt that were clearly uncomfortable with that. They asked him to disclaim that statement, and he did so. He disclaimed the statement that a rebound marriage was the intention of this statute. Senator Brown also testified back then. She was testifying on behalf of the Women's Rights Coalition. Her testimony, again, dealt more with the spouse a receiving spouse whose support had been terminated due to a temporary loss of income of the supporting spouse, not due to a remarriage. She also testified that...
Mr. Halpern, we got one more minute. Okay. I'm sorry to put this timely line. We've got another bill that we've had a lot of people come in for.
Okay. I guess I'll finish with my own example then, because that cuts to the chase. Subsequent to the introduction of this bill, my own case went to court. It went to before Judge Welch. There was no disagreement on the facts between my ex-spouse and myself. Our assets were divided evenly. She was awarded. She was given support through age 65. 3 months later, after our divorce, she remarried. I sued for termination of support, and support was terminated. A few months later, she, with her new spouse, who was a very well-to-do dentist, quit their jobs, moved to the South Pacific, lived on a sailboat for 4 or 5 years, chose not to work, all elective choices on her part, and then their marriage fell apart. She returned to Oregon and requested reinstatement of support. It went before Judge Welch, who strictly based on the 1977 court rulings and ORS 107.136 allowed reinstatement of support. So to summarize or to finalize, I feel that Senate Bill 945, the amended version, does not change the law. Rather, it simply clarifies the original intent of the legislators when the statute was passed in 1991. It does not alter the criteria used to determine the creation, modification, or termination of spousal support. It simply the courts will still have the discretion to continue or terminate support of upon remarriage of the spouse receiving support. It simply prevents reinstatement of support if the maintenance support obligation was terminated because the need for support was eliminated due to the remarriage. I understand there will obviously be people speaking against this. I would just say that that the Oregon Bar is not a unbiased party. In fact, I find it more than coincidental that the person representing the Oregon Bar happened to be the person representing my wife in the divorce.
Senator Pisanski?
We're getting into stuff that to me is not...
Let our witness speak for himself.
Right.
And thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Well, I just want to tell the committee that I've introduced this bill on behalf of Dr. Halpern because he's my constituent. And I'm not an expert in family law. What he says seems to make sense to me, but again, I'm not an expert in this area of law. But I appreciate your coming here, Doctor, and presenting me this piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. I do apologize for having to cut you short. I'm also going to cut short your opposition here. So with that, I will call Tom Bittner. I limited Ms. Dr. Halpern to 5 minutes, and you will have the same limitation.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Tom Bittner. I am appearing today on behalf of the Executive Committee for the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. I would like to point out that the Family Law Section has over 1,000 members, and it various sections of the bar sometimes have a real interest in certain things that have a counterpart section on the other side of the bar. There's a defense bar, criminal defense.
We understand how the bar works. Why don't you get to the bill? Thank you.
Well, my point, I guess, is that the family law bar opposes it. We represent both the Dr. Halperns of the world and his former spouse. So, Chair Burdick, my point is that the...
I'd like to just get to this. So, Mr. Bittner, I'm trying to figure out what I just heard is basically if someone terminates a marriage, they get into another marriage, they can get out of that marriage and then turn around and go back and say the first person is on the hook again for spousal support. Is that the position you're taking?
Under certain conditions that have been set forth in ORS 107.136. The original spousal support obligation as ordered would still have to be, you'd have to be within that time frame. So if the original support obligation was 10 years, your motion to reinstate would have to be made within that 10-year period. You couldn't come back in year 11 and file a motion to reinstate. Also, the reason that your support was terminated in the first instance would no longer be in existence. In other words, if you remarried and your spouse was of sufficient income level and you commingled your finances and so forth so that you no longer needed the assistance of the former spouse, that situation would have to go away before you could come back and seek spousal support from the prior spouse. And what would happen?
You might. Ringo?
But it seems to me that if you terminate, if somebody gets married again and the first support is terminated, that spouse, they've hitched their wagon to a different star, so to speak. I mean, they've said, okay, I'm now putting my life together with this person. So why should we be able to go back to the person number one when that didn't work?
They get married and they drive away from the church, and as they drive away from the church, they get T-boned at the intersection, and the spouse is killed. Where are you now? So in 1991, the legislature saw fit that it was important to prevent that very scenario, in fact, was the case that Mr. Soce brought to this committee in 1991 and got the support of the legislature to say, that's not right. That person, yes, they gave up their right to support from spouse one, but circumstances changed. The legislature gave the courts the discretion to reinstate. It's not an automatic reinstatement. We put our faith in the judges to evaluate each case on its own basis to determine whether or not it's appropriate.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And your example of getting T-boned on the way out of the wedding, is it automatic at marriage that the termination happens?
No.
So, Madam Chair, that doesn't really apply then because that
that person hasn't even been to a judge yet to try to get the spousal support terminated. So that's a ridiculous example.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, if I may address that, let me change my factual scenario somewhat then. They're remarried, and the former spouse files a motion and says, I'd like to terminate support. The recipient spouse says, okay, fine, I'll stipulate to that, but I'd like to make certain that I'm reserving my right to reinstate, which in this particular case, that's what was stated in the paper that terminated the support. So let's say it's terminated, and then following that, and all of that, like in this case, happened within 3 months of the divorce. They very well could have gone out on a Sunday shopping spree, been T-boned, and had her spouse killed. So the example is not that far-fetched.
It's true, they could have, but they didn't. And the example, I mean, again, you would have to go right back to what Senator Ringo said, is that you've hitched your cart to a different horse.
Star. Let's not say a horse in her bio.
So, I mean, in order for a judge to have terminated, obviously they made a decision that the spousal support wasn't needed anymore. So just because something happens, then why is that unlike this, you know, star one back on the hook?
Okay, why don't you get to the policy point, because I think that's what we're missing here. We're asking for what the policy reason for that kind of requirement is.
Policy reason is that the circumstances of the recipient spouse could be such that the need for spousal support from the original payor spring back into existence because the circumstances have changed. And in many cases, the court was without the power to do that in the past, and so the legislature saw fit to pass 136. Our position is that the bill as proposed, 136, takes a shot at one particular type of spousal support, spousal maintenance in particular, and says that that's the one that can't be reinstated upon remarriage. It's a single taxpayer bill, affects Dr. Halperin's case. In fact, spousal maintenance might, of the three types of spousal support, that's the one where you most likely would need to come back and seek a reinstatement, because spousal maintenance is designed to elevate your standard of living over a long period of time where there's a permanent disparity in income. And so the person who had their support terminated for a period of time, they knew that they had a long-term spousal support obligation to begin with, and it was terminated. They got the benefit of not paying it during that termination period, and if the circumstances change for the recipient spouse and they come back, the court should have the discretion to reinstate.
Senator Pruszynski, very quickly, and then I'm going to close.
I mean, the reality, I'm looking at what the Dash 3 amendments are, and I'm wondering if you could give us your comments if we modified it to be that basically as it states, but then say something to the effect like, unless there's a demonstration of extreme circumstances that have been demonstrated, you know, something that caused this to come back, or that the original parties have stipulated to the right for that individual to come back into this. I mean, I can see some balancing here. I mean, in this case, we're hearing two different stories. If there was stipulation, that's one thing. But, I mean, at the same time, even if you have an order that goes out and 65 years old, I don't know how the parties were, but I'm going to say it appears that at least 30 years or 35 years support ordered, that if they, I mean, 20 years later, they're able to reopen it back up. It just seems like
This seems like something that needs a broader discussion than one particular circumstance would dictate. Would you be willing, as a member of the family law section, to take this up in a more comprehensive way? This is really more an interim issue.
Absolutely. And in closing, and I know my time is up, I would like to point out, Chair Burdick, that I'm a member of the family law section, the Oregon Academy of Family Law Practitioners, these various organizations. The point of that is that we go to conferences and so forth. We meet with judges. There has not been an outcry from the family law bar saying this statute is a problem. We have, there are no cases from the appellate courts that give us bad examples and so forth. And so if the committee believes that there's a problem, the family law section would like the opportunity to work this up with the full support and input of our section, and we could get back to you next session.
Okay, let's have that on the agenda, and you can work with Ms. Graby to maybe set that up. We close the hearing on Senate Bill 945. Thank you. Apologize to the slight before for the time constraints. We're going to quickly take up Senate Bill 920. People need to leave. I will understand, but we have a lot of people, several people who came from far away. Open a hearing on Senate Bill 920. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 920 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. And what the bill does, it revises Oregon's laws relating to execution sales, directs the sheriff to levy, seize, or honor, sell real property of judgment, etc. It's a very comprehensive rewrite of a very complex and very old statute. And I know that Mr. Hendricks is here to fully explain both the bill and the very substantive dash-one amendments that we have. Dash-two, excuse me. I should say sub-bill along.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Hendricks, maybe you could come up and we'll try to get for the people who get to the people who traveled for this. Thank you.
Members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. Mr. Gerald Watson from the Oregon Law Commission is here.
I should have called you in the first place. Thanks.
You will get an initial quick run through of what the bill does.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gerald Watson, staff attorney with the Oregon Law Commission. And as Council Taylor has indicated, this bill is sponsored by this committee and was done so at the request of the Oregon Law Commission. I want to give you a quick background on the work of the Oregon Law Commission in this area, because in 2003, the Law Commission sponsored a bill dealing with judgments, also a very large bill, and at that time made a decision not to try to deal with execution procedures and judicial sales of property. Instead, following the 2003 session, the judgment work group, and that is the device, the working device through which the Law Commission functions, made a decision to look into this for 2005, appointed what was called a sub-work group of the judgments work group, which met throughout 2004, and into 2005, looking at this area of legislation. You have before you the work product, basically, of that group in the form of SB 920. That's received the approval of the Law Commission. You also should have, and I'm sorry I didn't bring those copies over. I've got 25 copies sitting in the green file there, I believe. No, got it here. My apologies. You should also have a copy of a summary of SB 920, and you'll note at the bottom of that cover sheet that I indicate that it is the summary that's not been gone through the approval of the Law Commission, because it was prepared subsequent to the last meeting. But the Law Commission has signed off on the bill itself. Absent the amendments which Mr. Hendricks will talk about. I don't know how much other background you really want or need on this. I've got several people that I've asked who have served on this work group, and it's met frequently for fairly long periods of time to talk. They have also signed up. And after Mr. Hendricks speaks, I would like to have Mark Comstock, Marshall Ross, and Brad Swank come up. I think they're in that order, and just indicate their support.
We're getting some pretty serious time constraints here. Do you have any estimate of how long this
I really think their remarks are going to be very short, and simply to the point that they participated in the process, and that they believe the product that came out is a good, workable one that makes a significant advance over the existing statute.
Nodding heads back there, we could shorten this up.
Yeah.
Could I also invite anybody that he just mentioned, Mr. Comstock, Mr. Ross, and Mr. Swank, if you would like to come up here and say anything, if there's anything you wanted to say. I know some of you came from a ways, and you're welcome to come up and join them if you'd like to say something. I apologize for the time constraints. I'm trying to avoid night meetings, and that's what happens. So please proceed.
Okay. I will not go over the summary. I think it is tracks paragraph, essentially section by section of the bill, and very briefly explains it. But quickly, however, where we get all of this comes from the fact that courts sometimes enter judgments, and judgments call for someone to pay money to someone or some other transfer property to someone, and ultimately it may be necessary for some further procedures to be implemented for that to occur. That's what an execution process is all about, and then properties which are acquired through execution are sometimes sold. This bill tries to deal with laws that date back 50 or more years in some cases, then amended over the years, some amendments in the 80s and so forth. With the changing economy that we've got, changing technology and other things, we have there was a feeling that we needed to clarify and update and simplify this process. And I believe that that's what this bill accomplishes, and I will stop at that point, and unless you have any questions, turn it over to Mr. Hendricks.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Verdick, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks. I won't say too much on this. It's a very technical area of the law, as you can tell just by a quick read through. It's primarily about how you go about enforcing a judgment, what happens when you get to the point where you're down to your last recourse to collect on it, i.e. by selling property. You had a bill in front of you today that talked about the homestead exemption. That's integral to this whole process because that prevents you from selling a homestead if it's below the value specified. But that's what this bill is about, is when you get to the point where the creditor says, I now have to sell property in order to collect on this debt. It's an extremely complicated process, primarily because of the what's called redemption rights. When you sell a person's property, they have the right to come back within a certain period of time and buy that property back, basically by paying the amount that was paid at the judgment sale. Not only that, certain other lien creditors, people who have liens against property, can also do that as part of the process. And frankly, the Dash 2 amendments were primarily aimed at doing a cleaner write-up of the redemption rights because it's one piece we just didn't have time to do quite adequately during the work group process. I will tell you that this work group probably spent more time and worked harder than they did on that huge judgment bill you had last session in trying to put this together because of the huge complexities that are involved in this area, because of the different types of property that you might be dealing with. The old law kind of looked at it and they saw real property and they saw tangible personal property. The sheriffs who participated in the work group would start talking about people coming in and wanting to sell things like domain names on the internet, and how did that work underneath these old statutes that were written probably before the turn of the last century, back in the 1800s. And so I guess the one thing I would say is, having drafted for these folks, it was an incredible amount of work. I think the product they produced is is a good product that I can, as far as I can tell from a technical viewpoint, you should be aware that it is not without substantive changes in the law. This is not just a cleanup. There were lots of decisions made about, for instance, the type of property that could be sold under a judgment, the type of properties that have redemption rights, a lot of issues about manufactured homes and the way they're sold. They were all kind of hashed out, and I think everybody's happy at where they arrived. But you should not be under the impression that this is just a cleanup bill, because that it is not. It does have a lot of substantive changes in the way things will work.
Thank you. And I think we'll probably ask you to come back. And Mr. Watson, where are you from? Are you from Salem here?
I am from Salem.
You are? Yeah. Well, maybe we could have the both of you come back when we take this up in more depth, because we just don't have time to do justice to it today. So I think what we'll do is take our sheriff's people, and if you want to just make a quick comment, we'd appreciate it. And again, apologies for running out of time. We just got caught up with these dog things today. Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marshall Ross. I'm a senior deputy with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I supervise the civil unit. The Oregon Law Commission invited the sheriffs to participate in a sub-work group. Deputy leader from Washington County and I participated. And the OLC assisted in placing the sheriffs in their proper ministerial role in writing this bill. Sheriffs don't want any discretion when we execute these kinds of court order. We want to follow court orders and clear statutes. We don't want to get sucked into the middle of of somebody's civil lawsuit. And the OLC was careful in recognizing that the sheriff is a ministerial officer, and much of the work on this bill is to continue to place us in a ministerial capacity and take us out of some of the ambiguities that previously existed, where the sheriff at times had to use discretion, which we do not want to use.
Appreciate that very much.
Chair Burdick, my name is Mark Comstock. I'm a private practitioner here in Salem. I've been practicing in this area for almost 25 years. I just wanted to highlight to the committee that this is the product of a work group that, in fact, came to consensus and worked. It had the members of the private bar, who represent creditors and debtors. It also had the sheriff's departments that brought some practicality to what they actually do. Had the court's representatives that brought that perspective to the committee. The bill and the Dash 2 amendment that you have here clarifies and specifically assists both creditors and debtors and the practicing bar and the ministerial representatives that actually do the work in understanding the law and making it work. And I want to urge this committee to adopt the Dash 2 amendment and pass out the bill with a DPAS recommendation, because it is one that cleans up and clarifies a very arcane area of the law.
Thank you very much, and I see that you're from Salem as well, so if we need to, maybe we can drag you back, and we won't have to drag you back, Mr. Ross, because we have your able representative, John Powell, back there, who will be able to make sure that we stay strictly in the line of ministerial where sheriffs are concerned. So I appreciate it, and thank you for your patience in waiting and your tolerance for being cut so short. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 920. We will put over the rest of the agenda we're not going to... Let's see. 850.
I don't think you want to put
this one. 850. Yes. We'll put Senate Bill 850 over till tomorrow. And the other ones we will schedule as appropriate. Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you, Senator Starr.
Well, sorry to have been late.